little. The lords cannot bear the thought of a woman's rule. They cannot bear to even think that a woman can rule. It is as if they want to put her back into the confinement chamber. It is as if the king, her husband, by falling asleep, has set her free, free to command the kingdom, and that the duty of all the other great men is to return her to him. If they could put her to sleep like him, I think they would. The queen is confined to Windsor. Richard is trapped in Calais. I live as her lady-in-waiting, as an estranged wife. But in truth, we all wait. Every day Margaret goes to see the king, and every day he neither sees her nor hears her. She commands the doctors to be gentle with him, but sometimes her own temper snaps, and she goes in and rails at him, cursing into his deaf ears. I live with the queen, and I long for Richard, and I am aware all the time of the rise of trouble on the streets of London, the danger on the country roads, the rumours that the North is up against the Duke of York, or up for their own ambitions. Who knows with these wild lands on the border? The Queen is plotting. I'm sure of it. She asks me one day if I write to Richard, and I tell her that I write often, and send my letters with the wool merchants taking the fleeces to Calais. She asks if the ships come back empty. If they were to carry men, how many could be landed? If they could sail laden up to the river, to the Tower. You are thinking that they could come from Calais and rescue the Duke of Somerset from the Tower, I say flatly. That would be to ask my husband to lead an invasion against the regent and protector of England. But in defence of the king, she says. How could anyone call that treason? I don't know, I say miserably. I don't know what treason is anymore. The plan comes to nothing, for we get news of an uprising in Calais. The soldiers have not been paid, and they lock up their offices in the barracks and raid the town and seize the trade goods and sell them and keep the money for their wages. There are reports of looting and rioting. The Queen finds me in the stable yard of Windsor Castle, ordering my horse to be saddled and a guard to come with me to London. I have to know what's happening, I say to her. He could be in terrible danger. I have to know. He won't be in danger, she assures me. His men love him. They may have locked him in his quarters so that they can raid the wool stores, but they won't hurt him. You know how beloved he is, both he and Lord Wells. The men will release him when they've stolen their wages and drunk the town dry. They bring my horse to me, and I climb up on the mounting block and into the saddle, awkward with my big belly. I'm sorry, Your Grace, but I need to know that for myself. I'll come back to you as soon as I know he's safe. She raises a hand to me. Yes, come back without fail, she says. It is a lonely, lonely place here. I wish I could sleep the days away like my husband. I wish I could close my eyes and sleep forever, too. I hardly know where to go in London to get news. My house has been closed down. There's no one there but a few guards for safety. The Parliament is not sitting. The Duke of York is no friend of mine. In the end, I go to the wife of Lord Wells, who is commanding in Calais with Richard. My manservant announces me, and I walk into her solar chamber. I can guess why you have come, she says, rising and kissing me formally on the cheek. How is Her Grace the Queen? She's well in her health, thank God. And the King? God bless him, he is no better. She nods and sits down and gestures me to take a stool near hers. Her two daughters come forwards with a glass of wine and biscuits, and then step back, as well-behaved girls should do, so that the adults can talk in private. Charming girls, I remark. She nods. She knows I have sons who will have to marry well. The oldest one is betrothed, she says delicately. I smile. I hope she will be happy. I have come to you for news of my husband. I have heard nothing. Have you any news of Calais? I ask. She shakes her head. I'm sorry. There is no news to be had. The last ship to get out of the port said that there was an uprising, the soldiers insisting on their pay. They had captured the wool store and were selling the goods for their own profit. They were holding the ships in the harbour. Since then, the merchants will not send their cargoes to Calais for fear that their own stocks are captured. So I don't know anything, and I can't get any news. Did they say what your husband, or mine, was doing? I ask. I have a great feeling of dread that Richard would not sit idly by while his men took the law into their own hands. I know they are both alive, she says. Or at any rate they were 3 weeks ago. I know your husband cautioned the men and said that what they were doing was common theft, and they threw him into a cell. She sees the terror on my face and puts her hand on mine. Really, they didn't hurt him, but locked him up. You will have to be brave, my dear. I swallow down the tears. It has been so long since we've been at home together, I say, and he's had one hard service after another. We are all lost under the rule of a sleeping king, she says gently. The tenants on my land say that nothing will grow. Nothing will ever grow in a kingdom where the king himself lies like a fallow field. Will you go back to court? I give a little sigh. I have to, I say simply. The queen commands it, and the king says nothing. In August, I go to Grafton to see my children, and I try to explain to the older ones, Anne, Anthony, and Mary, that the king is well, but sleeping, that the queen has done nothing wrong, but is confined with him, that their father's commander, Edmund Beaufort, Duke of Somerset, is in the Tower, accused but not on trial, and that their father, and it is at this point that I have to grit my teeth and try to appear calm, their father is commanding the castle of Calais, but is imprisoned by his own soldiers. The constable of Calais is now Richard, Duke of York, and sooner or later their father will have to answer to him. Surely the Duke of York will hold Calais, just as Duke of Somerset would have done, Anthony suggests. Father won't like a new commander being put over him, but nobody can doubt that the Duke of York will send money to pay the soldiers and arms for the castle, won't he? I don't know. I think of the terrible year when I saw Richard wear himself out trying to hold soldiers to a cause, when they had neither weapons nor wages. He should do, I say carefully. But we none of us can be sure what the Duke will do, even what he can do. He has to govern as if he's king, but he is not king. He is only a lord among many lords, and some of them don't even like him. I just hope he does not blame your father for holding Calais for England. I just hope he lets him come home. I go into my confinement in Grafton, sending a message to Richard when the baby is safely born. She is a girl, a beautiful girl, and I call her Margaret, for the Queen, who is beating against the times we live in, like a bird against a window. I come out of confinement and see my little girl in the arms of my wet nurse, and then kiss my other children. I have to go back to court, I say. The Queen needs me. The autumn is long and quiet for us in Windsor. Slowly the trees start to grow yellow and then golden. The king gets no better. He doesn't change at all. The baby prince starts to pull himself up to his feet so that he can stand, and tries to take his first steps. This is the most interesting thing that happens in the whole year. Our world shrinks to the castle, and our lives to watching over a small baby and a sick man. The queen is a doting mother. She comes to the little prince's nursery morning and night, and she visits her husband every afternoon. It is like living under a spell. And we watch the baby grow as if we feared he might do nothing but sleep. Half a dozen of us always go to the nursery in the morning, as if we have to see for sure that the little prince has woken after another night. Apart from this, we go through the motions of a court, attending on the king. But all we can do is sit with him as he sleeps. Every afternoon we sit with him and watch the slow rise and fall of his chest. Richard sends me a letter as soon as he can get his reports into the hands of a ship's captain. He writes to the King's Council, pointedly he does not address the Lord Protector, to say that the men cannot be commanded without wages. Without money from the treasury, the merchants of Calais are forced to pay for their own defence. The garrison there regards itself almost independent of England. Richard asks the council for orders, though he points out that it is only he and Lord Wells who are waiting for orders. All the rest, the great garrison, the soldiers, the sailors in the port, the merchants and the citizens, are taking the law into their own hands. To me, he writes to say that no one in the town accepts the lordship of the Duke of York. No one knows what to believe about the king. And do I think Edmund Beaufort is likely to get out of the Tower and reclaim his power? At the very end of the letter, he writes to me that he loves and misses me. "I count the days," he writes. "I am heartsore without you, my beloved. As soon as I can hand over this garrison to a new commander, I will come home to you. But I do believe that if I were not here now, the town would fall to the French, who know full well the straits we are in. I am doing my duty as best I can to the poor king and to our poor country, as I know you are too. But when I come home this time, I swear I will never be parted from you again." Windsor Castle, winter, 1454. The Duke of York, determined to show his mastery over Calais and to prevent a French attack, musters a small fleet and takes ship to the garrison, saying he will enter it, pay the soldiers, make peace with the Calais merchants, hang any traitors, and be recognized as the Constable of Calais. Calais is formidably fortified. It has been England's outpost in Normandy for generations, and now the soldiers have control of the fort. When they see the sails of York's fleet, they place the chain across the mouth of the harbour and turn the guns of the castle to the seaward side. York finds himself staring down the barrel of his own cannon, refused entry to his own city. They bring the news to us as we are sitting with the king one cold afternoon in November. Margaret is exultant. "I will see your husband honoured for this," she exclaims. "How York must be humbled! How shamed he must be! Out at sea with a great fleet, and the city of Calais refusing him entry! Surely now the lords will put him out of office! Surely they will fetch Edmund from the Tower!" I say nothing. Of course, all I'm wondering is whether my husband will have stood by while his men mutinied, disobeying his order to admit their new captain. Or whether, and far worse, far more dangerous for us, he himself led them to defy the Duke of York, commanding them from the High Tower to turn the guns on the Lord Regent, the legally appointed protector of England. Either way, he will be in danger. Either way, the Duke is his enemy from this hour. The King, strapped in his chair, makes a little noise in his sleep. The Queen doesn't even glance at him. Think of York, bobbing about in his ship, and the guns trained down on him, she gloats. I wish to God they'd shot him. Think how it would be for us if they'd only sunk his ship, and he'd drowned. Think if your Richard had sunk him, I cannot stop myself from shuddering. Surely, Richard would never have allowed his garrison to open fire on a royal duke appointed by the king's council. I am sure of that. I have to be sure of that. It's treason, I say simply. Whether we like York or not, he is appointed by Privy Council and Parliament to rule in the king's place with his authority. It would be treason to attack him. And to have Calais open fire on English ships is a terrible thing to show to the French. She shrugs. Oh, who cares? To be appointed by his own place, men, is no appointment. She says, I did not appoint him. The king did not appoint him. As far as I'm concerned, he's just seized power. He is a usurper. And your husband should have shot him as soon as he was in range. Your husband failed to shoot him. He should have killed him when he could. Again, the king makes a little noise. I go to his side. Did you speak, Your Grace? I ask him. Do you hear us talking? Can you hear me? The Queen is at his side. She touches his hand. Wake up, she says. It is all she ever says to him. Wake up. Amazingly, for a moment, he stirs. Truly, he does. For the first time in more than a year, he turns his head, opens his eyes, and sees. I know he does. He sees our absolutely amazed faces, and then he gives a little sigh, closes his eyes, and sleeps again. Physicians! The Queen screams and runs to the door, tears it open, and shouts for the doctors who are dining and drinking and resting in the presence room outside. The King is awake! The King is awake! They come tumbling into the room, wiping their mouths on their sleeves, putting down their glasses of wine, leaving their games of chess. They surround him, listen to his chest, raise his eyelids, and peer into his eyes. They tap his temples and prick his hands with pins. But he has slid away into sleep again.
Did he speak?
No. He just opened his eyes and gave a little sigh, and then went back to sleep. He glances towards the Queen and lowers his voice. And his face, was it the look of a madman when he woke? Was there any understanding in his eyes, or was he blank, like an idiot? I think for a moment. No, he looked just like himself, only coming from a deep sleep. Do you think he will wake now? The excitement in the room is dying down very fast, as everyone realizes that the king is quite inert, though they go on pulling him and patting him and speaking loudly in his ears. No, the man says. He's gone again. The queen turns, her face dark with anger. Can't you wake him? Slap him! No. The little court at Windsor has been settled for so long to a routine that revolves around the Queen and her little boy, who is now learning to speak, and can now stagger from one waiting hand to another. But things are changing. In the King's rooms, I think he's beginning to stir. They've been watching over him, and feeding him and washing him, but they'd given up trying to cure him, as nothing that they did seemed to make any difference. Now we are starting to hope again that in his own time, and without any physic, he's coming out of his sleep. I've taken to sitting with him for the morning, and another lady waits with him till evening. The Queen visits briefly every afternoon. I've been watching him, and I think his sleep is lifting. I think it is getting lighter. And sometimes I'm almost certain that he can hear what we say. Of course, I start to wonder what he will know when he comes out of his sleep. More than a year ago, he saw a sight so shocking that he closed his eyes and went to sleep so that he could see it no more. The last words he heard were mine, when I said, "Don't look. Don't see." If he is opening his eyes again, ready to look, ready to see, I cannot help but wonder what he will remember, what he will think of me, and if he will think that I am to blame for his long vigil in darkness and silence. I grow so concerned that I dare to ask the Queen if she thinks the King will blame us for the shock of his illness. She looks at me limpidly. "You mean the terrible news from France?" she says. "The way he learned it," I reply. "You were so distressed, and the Duke was there. I was there too. Do you think the King might feel that we should have told him the bad news with more care?" "Yes," she says. "If he ever gets well enough to hear us, we will say that we were sorry that we did not prepare him for the shock. It was so terrible for us all. I myself cannot remember anything about that evening. I think I fainted, and the Duke tried to revive me. But I don't remember." "No," I agree with her, understanding that this is the safest course for us all. "Neither do I." We celebrate Christmas in the hall of Windsor Castle. It is a little feast for a sadly diminished household, but we have gifts and fairings for each other and little toys for the baby prince. And then, just a few days after Christmas Day, the King wakes, and this time he stays awake. It is a miracle. He just opens his eyes and yawns and looks around him, surprised to be seated in a chair in his privy chamber in Windsor, surrounded by strangers. The doctors rush for us, and the Queen and I go in alone. "Better not frighten him with a great crowd," she says. We go in quietly, almost as if we're approaching some wounded animal that might take fright. The King is rising to his feet, a doctor on either side to help him support himself. He is unsteady, but he lifts his head when he sees the Queen, and he says uncertainly, "Ah." I can almost see him seeking her name in the confusion in his mind. "Margaret," he says at last. "Margaret of Anjou." I find there are tears in my eyes, and I'm holding back sobs at the wreck of this man who was born to be King of England, and who I first knew when he was a boy as handsome as little Edward March, the York boy. Now, this hollowed-out man takes one tottering step, and the Queen makes a deep curtsy to him. She does not reach out to touch him. She does not go into his arms. It is like the young woman and the Fisher King in the legend. She lives with him, but they never touch. "Your Grace, I am glad to see you well again," she says quietly.
"Have I been ill?"
One deeply secret glance passes between her and me. "You fell asleep, into a deep sleep, and no one could wake you."
"Really?"
He passes his hand over his head, and he sees for the first time the scar from a burning poultice on his arm.
"Gracious me! Did I bump myself? How long was I asleep?"
She hesitates. "A long time," I say. "And though you were asleep for a long time, the country is safe."
"That's good," he says. "Hi-ho!"
He nods to the men who are holding him up.
"Help me to the window."
He shuffles like an old man to the window and looks out at the water meadows and the river that still flows through the frosty white banks, just as it always did. He narrows his eyes against the glare.
"It's very bright," he complains.
He turns and goes back to his chair.
"I'm very tired."
"Don't!" An involuntary cry escapes from the Queen. They ease him back into his chair, and I see him observe the straps on the arms and on the seat. I see him consider them, owlishly blinking. and then he looks around the stark bareness of the room. He looks at the table of physic. He looks at me.
How long was it, Jacquetta?
I press my lips together to hold back an outburst. It was a long time. But we are so pleased you are better now. If you sleep now, you will wake up again, won't you, Your Grace? You will try to wake up again. I really fear he's going back to sleep. His head is nodding, and his eyes are closing. I am so tired, he says, like a little child. And in a moment, he is asleep again. We sit up through the night in case he wakes again. But he does not. In the morning, the Queen is pale and strained with anxiety. The doctors go in to him at 7 in the morning and gently touch his shoulder, whisper in his ear that it is morning. And to their amazement, he opens his eyes and sits up in his bed, and orders that the shutters be open. He lasts till dinner time, just after midday, and then sleeps again, but he wakes for his supper and asks for the Queen, and when she enters the privy chamber, he orders a chair to be set for her, and asks her how she does. I am standing behind her chair as she answers him that she's well, and then she asks, gently, if he remembers that she was with child when he fell asleep. His surprise is unfeigned. No, he exclaims. I remember nothing. With child, did you say? Gracious, no. She nods. Indeed, yes. We were very happy about it. She shows him the jewel he had made for her. She had it in its case, ready to remind him. You gave me this to celebrate the news. Did I? He's quite delighted with it. He takes it in his hand and looks at it. Very good workmanship. I must have been pleased. She swallows. You were. We were. The whole country was pleased. We're waiting for him to ask after the baby, but clearly he's not going to ask after the baby. His head nods as if he's drowsy. He gives a tiny little snore. Margaret glances at me. Do you not want to know about the child? I prompt. You see the jewel that you gave the Queen when she told you she was with child? That was nearly 2 years ago. The baby has been born. He blinks and turns to me. His look is quite without understanding. What child? I go to the door and take Edward from his waiting nurse. Luckily, he is sleepy and quiet. I would not have dared to bring him lustily bawling into this hushed chamber. This is the Queen's baby, I say. Your baby. The Prince of Wales, God bless him. Edward stirs in his sleep. His sturdy little leg kicks out. He is a toddler, handsome and strong. So unlike a newborn baby that my confidence wavers even as I carry him towards the King. He's so heavy in my arms, a healthy child of 15 months. It seems nonsensical to be presenting him to his father like a newborn. The King looks at him with as much detachment as if I'm bringing a fat little lamb into the royal rooms. I had no idea of it, he says. And is it a girl or a boy? The Queen rises up, takes Edward from me, and proffers the sleeping child to the King. He shrinks away. No, no, I don't want to hold it. Just tell me, is this a boy or a girl? A boy, the Queen says, her voice quavering with disappointment at his response. A boy, thank God. An heir to your throne, the son we prayed for. He inspects the rosy face. A child of the Holy Spirit, he says wonderingly. No, your own true-born son, The Queen corrects him sharply. I look and see that the doctors and their servants and two or three ladies in waiting will have heard this damning pronouncement from the King. He is the Prince, Your Grace, a son and heir for you, and a prince for England. The Prince of Wales. We christened him Edmund.
Edward, I snap, Edward.
She recovers herself. Edward. He is Prince Edward of Lancaster. The King smiles radiantly.
Oh, a boy. That's a bit of luck.
You have a boy, I say. A son and heir. Your son and heir. God bless him.
Amen, he says.
I take the little boy from the Queen, and she sinks down again into her chair. The boy stirs, and I hold him against my shoulder and rock gently. He smells of soap and warm skin.
And is he baptized?
The King asks conversationally. I can see Margaret grit her teeth with irritation at the slow questioning of those terrible days.
Yes, she says pleasantly enough. Yes, he is baptized, of course. And who are the godparents? Did I choose them?
No, you were asleep. I chose Archbishop Kemp, Edmund Beaufort, Duke of Somerset, and Anne, Duchess of Buckingham.
Just who I would have chosen, the King declares, smiling. My particular friends. Anne who?
Buckingham, the Queen enunciates carefully. The Duchess of Buckingham. But I am grieved to tell you that the Archbishop is dead. The King throws up his hands in wonder.
No. Why, how long have I been asleep?
18 months, Your Grace, I say quietly. 1.5 years. It has been a long time. We were all of us very afraid for your health. It is very good to see you well again. He looks at me with his childlike, trusting gaze.
It is a long time, but I remember nothing of the sleep, not even my dreams.
Do you remember falling asleep? I ask him quietly, hating myself.
Not at all, he chuckles. Only last night. I can only remember falling asleep last night. I hope when I sleep tonight that I wake up again in the morning.
Amen, I say. The Queen has her face in her hands.
I don't want to sleep another year away, he jokes.
Margaret shudders and then straightens up and folds her hands in her lap. Her face is like stone.
It must have been very inconvenient for you all, he says benevolently, looking around the privy chamber.
He doesn't seem to understand that he's been abandoned by his court, that the only people here are his doctors and nurses, and us, his fellow prisoners.
I shall try not to do it again.
We will leave you now, I say quietly.
This has been a great day for us all.
I am very tired, he says confidingly, but I do hope to wake tomorrow. Amen, I say again. He beams like a child.
It will be as God wills. We are all of us in his hands.
The Palace of Placentia, Greenwich, London, Spring 1455. With the King awake, it is not to be how God wills, but how the Queen wills. She sends a message at once to the Council of Lords, so explosive in tone and so dangerous in temper that they release the Duke of Somerset at once from the Tower, laying on him the embargo that he may not go within 20 miles of the King, nor engage in any form of political life. The Duke, setting his London house in order, and speedily arming his retinue, sends at once to his friends and allies, and tells them that no one will keep him from the king, and that the Duke of York will be the first to realize that he has seized power. As if to celebrate their return to the centre of England, the king and the queen open the palace at Greenwich and summon the lords. The Duke of York obeys the summons and resigns his position as protector of the realm, and finds his other title, that of Constable of Calais, is to be lost too. It is given back once more to Edmund Beaufort, Duke of Somerset, out of jail, and gloriously returned to greatness. He walks into the Queen's rooms in the palace, as handsomely and richly dressed as if he'd been to the court of Burgundy for new clothes, not waiting for his trial for treason in the Tower. The wheel of fortune has thrown him high again, and there is no greater man at the court. All the ladies flutter as he comes into the room. Nobody can take their eyes off him. He kneels in the centre of the room to Margaret, who flies across the room, her hands outstretched the moment she sees him. He bows his dark head and takes both of her hands to his lips, inhaling the perfume on her fingers. The maid in waiting beside me lets out a little envious sigh. Margaret stands completely still, quivering at his touch. Then she very quietly says, "Please rise, my lord. We are glad to see you at liberty again." He gets to his feet in one graceful movement and offers her his arm. "Shall we walk?" he suggests, and the two of them lead the way into the great gallery. I follow with a lady in waiting, and I nod to the rest of them to stay where they are. Carefully, I dawdle behind, so that my companion cannot overhear their whispered speech. He bows and leaves her at the end of the gallery, and Margaret turns to me, her face alight. "He's going to advise the king that the Duke of York need not be admitted to the council," she says delightedly. "We're only going to have those of the House of Lancaster around us. Anything that York gained while he was protector will be taken away from him. And his brother-in-law, the Earl of Salisbury, and that overgrown cub, Richard Neville, the Earl of Warwick, will not be invited either. Edmund says that he will turn the king against our enemies, and that they will be banned from all positions of power." She laughs. "Edmund says that they will be sorry for the day they put him in the Tower, and confined me to Windsor. He says they will go on their knees to me. He says the king hardly knows where he is, or what he's doing, and that between us, the two of us can command him. We will throw down our enemies, perhaps into jail, perhaps to the gallows." I put out my hand to her. "Your Grace." But she's too delighted with the thought of revenge to hear a word of caution. "Edmund says that we have everything to play for now. We have the king, returned to health and willing to do whatever we say. We have a son and heir that nobody can deny. And we can teach York a lesson that he will never forget. Edmund says that if we can prove York was planning to usurp the throne, then he's a dead man." Now I do interrupt. "Your Grace, surely this is going to send the Duke of York into outright rebellion. He's bound to defend himself against such charges. He will demand that the council renew the charges against the Duke of Somerset, and then it will be the two of you and yours against him and his." "No," she replies, "for the king himself has declared before the lords that Somerset is a true friend and loyal kinsman, and nobody will dare say anything against him. We are going to hold a council at Westminster, and York is not to be invited. And then we're going to hold a hearing against him in Leicester, where he will be accused in his absence. And the Midlands are loyal to us, though London is sometimes uncertain. This is the end of the Duke in his pride, and the beginning of my revenge on him." I shake my head. There's nothing I can say to make her see that the Duke of York is too powerful to force into enmity. "You, of all people, should be pleased," she exclaims. Edmund promises me that he will bring your husband Richard home.
Everyone has their price. Richard is mine. At once I forget to urge caution. I grasp her hands.
He will. He promised me. The king is going to give Edmund the keys to Calais in front of everyone. Richard will be commended as a loyal commander and come home to you. York will be arrested. The kingdom will be ruled rightly by Edmund Beaufort and me, and we will all be happy again.
I am happy. I am in his arms, my face crushed against his padded jacket, his arms around me as tight as a bear, so that I cannot breathe. When I look up into his beloved, weary face, he kisses me so hard that I close my eyes and think myself a besotted girl again. I catch a breath, and he kisses me some more. Dockyard workers and sailors shout encouragement and bawdy comments, but Richard doesn't even hear them. Beneath my cloak, his hands stray from my waist and clutch at my hips.
"Stop right there," I whisper.
"Where can we go?" he asks, as if we were young again.
"Come to the palace," I say. "Come on. Are your things packed?"
"Damn my things," he says cheerfully. We walk hand fast from the dockyard at Greenwich towards the palace, creep in by the back stairs like a lad and a slut from the stables, bolt my door, and stay bolted in all day and all night. At midnight, I send for some food, and we eat wrapped in sheets, besides the warm fire.
"When shall we go to Grafton?"
"Tomorrow," he says. "I want to see my children and my new daughter. Then I shall come straight back, and I shall have to take ship to Quetta."
"Ship?" I ask.
He grimaces. "I have to take Beaufort's orders myself," he says. "The fort has been torn apart from the inside out. I can't leave them without a captain. I shall stay until the Duke replaces me, and then I shall come straight home to you."
"I thought you were home now,"
I cry out. "Forgive me," he says. "I would fear for the garrison if I didn't go back. Truly, my love, these have been terrible days."
"And then will you come home?"
"The Queen has promised, the Duke has promised, and I promise it," he says. He leans forwards and pulls a lock of my hair. "It is hard to serve a country such as ours, Jaquetta. But the King is well now, and taking his power. Our house is in the ascendancy again." I put my hand over his.
"My love, I wish it were so. But it's not as easy as this. When you see the court tomorrow, you will see."
"Tomorrow," he says, puts his jug of ale aside, and takes me back to bed.
We snatch a few days together, long enough for Richard to understand that the Queen and the Duke plan to turn the tables entirely, and accuse Richard of York of treason, and throw him and his allies down. We ride to Grafton in thoughtful silence. Richard greets his children, admires the new baby, and tells them that he has to return to Calais to keep order at the garrison, but that he will come home again.
"Do you think that they will persuade the Duke of York to beg pardon?" I ask him, as he's saddling his horse in the stable yard. "And if he confesses and obeys the king, will you be able to come straight home?"
"He did so before," my husband says steadily. "And the king, sick or well, is still the king. The queen and the duke believe that they have to attack Richard of York to defend themselves, and if they defeat him, then they will be proved right. I have to keep Calais for England, and for my own honour. And then I will come home. I love you, my wife. I will be home soon.
At first, the plan goes beautifully. Richard returns to Calais, pays the soldiers, and tells the garrison the king is in his power again, advised by the Duke of Somerset, and the House of Lancaster is in the ascendancy. The Privy Council turn against the man they called on as their saviour, and agree to meet without the Duke of York. They choose the safe haven of Leicester for this meeting, the heartlands of the Queen's influence, her favourite county, and the traditional base for the House of Lancaster. Their choosing Leicester makes them feel safe, but it tells me, and anyone else who cares to consider, that they are afraid of what the citizens will think in London, of what they will say in the villages of Sussex, of what they will do in Jack Cade's home of Kent. It's hard to get everyone to act. The lords and the gentry have to be summoned. The plan has to be explained, so that everyone understands the Duke of York is to be ill-paid for loyal service to the country, his achievements traduced, and he and his allies are to be excluded from the council, and the country turned against them. The king is so slow to leave for Leicester that he comes to bid farewell to the queen, Edmund Beaufort on his right, Henry Stafford, Duke of Buckingham on his left, on the very day that he said he would arrive in Leicester. His nobility behind him are dressed for the road, some wearing light armour, most of them dressed as if riding out for pleasure. I look from one familiar face to another. There is not a man here who is not either kin to the House of Lancaster or paid by the House of Lancaster. This is no longer the court of England, drawing on the support of many families, of many houses. This is the court of the House of Lancaster, and anyone who is not part of it is an outsider, and anyone who is an outsider is an enemy. The king bows low to Margaret, and she formally wishes him a safe journey and prosperous return. "I'm sure it will be easily done and peacefully concluded," he says vaguely. "My cousin, the Duke of York, cannot be allowed to defy my authority. My authority, you know. I have told the Yorkist lords that they are to disband their armies. They can keep 200 men each. 200 should be enough, shouldn't it?" He looks at the Duke of Somerset. 200 is fair, isn't it?" "More than fair," replies Edmund, who has about 500 men in livery, and another 1,000 tenants whom he can call up at a moment's notice. "So I shall bid you farewell, and see you at Windsor when this work is done," the king says. He smiles at Beaufort and the Duke of Buckingham. "My good kinsmen will take care of me, I know. You can be sure that they will be at my side." We go down to the great doorway to wave as they ride by. The king's standard goes in front, then the royal guard, and the king comes next. He is wearing riding clothes for the journey. He looks thin and pale compared to the two most favoured dukes on either side of him. As they go by, the Duke of Somerset pulls off his hat to Margaret and holds it to his heart. Hidden by her veil, she puts her fingers to her lips. The lesser noblemen, then the gentry, then the men-at-arms follow. There must be about 2,000 men riding out with the king, and they rumble past us, the great war horses with their mighty hooves, the smaller horses carrying goods and gear, and then the booted tramp of the foot soldiers who march in disciplined ranks, and the stragglers who follow. The queen is restless at the palace of Placentia, though the household is confident and busy, waiting for news of the king's success with his hand-picked council. The gardens that run down to the river are beautiful with the white and pale pink of dancing cherry blossom. When we walk to the river in a wind, the petals whirl about us like snow and make the little prince laugh, and he chases after them, his nursemaid bowed after him as he wobbles on his fat little legs. In the fields at the riverside, the late daffodils are still bobbing their butter-yellow heads, and the hedges of the meadows are burnished white with flowers, the blackthorn thickly blooming on black spikes, the hawthorn a budding green of promise. At the riverside, the willows rustle their boughs together and lean over the clear water, green water below, reflecting the green leaves above. In the chapel, we are still saying prayers for the health of the king and giving thanks for his recovery. But nothing cheers the queen. She cannot forget that she was imprisoned by the lords of her own country, forced to wait on a sleeping husband, fearful that she would never be free again. She cannot forgive Richard, Duke of York, for the humiliation. She cannot be happy when the only man who stood by her in those hard months, enduring captivity as she did, has marched away again to meet their enemy. She doesn't doubt that he will be victorious, but she cannot be happy without him. Margaret shudders as she comes into her apartments, though there's a good fire in the grate, and bright tapestries on the walls, and the last rays of the sun are warming the pretty rooms. "I wish they had not gone," she says. "I wish they'd summoned the Duke of York to London to answer us here." I don't remind her that York is a great favourite in London. The guilds and the merchants trust his calm common sense, and flourished when he established peace and good order in the city and country. While the Duke was Lord Protector, the tradesmen could send their goods out along the safe roads, and taxes were reduced with the profligate royal household under his control. "They'll be back soon," I say. "Perhaps York will plead forgiveness, as he did before, and they will all come back soon." Her uneasiness affects everyone. We dine in the Queen's rooms, not in the great hall, where the men-at-arms and the men of the household grumble that there is no cheer, even though the king has recovered. They say that the court is not how it should be. It is too silent. It is like an enchanted castle, under a spell of quietness. The queen ignores the criticism. She summons musicians to play only to her, in her rooms, and the younger ladies dance, but they only go through the paces without the handsome young men of the king's retinue to watch them. Finally, she commands one of the ladies-in-waiting to read to us from a romance, and we sit and sew and listen to a story about a queen who longed for a child in midwinter and gave birth to a baby who was made entirely of snow. When the child grew to manhood, her husband took him on crusade, and he melted away into the hot sand, poor boy. And then they had no son, not even one made of ice. This miserable story makes me ridiculously sentimental, and I feel disposed to sit and weep and brood over my boys at Grafton, Lewis, whom I will never see again, and my oldest, Anthony, 13 this year, who must soon have his own armour and go and serve as a squire to his father, or another great man. He has grown up in no time, and I wish he were a baby again, and I could carry him on my hip. It makes me long to be with Richard again. We've never been so long apart in our lives before. When the Duke of York is thrown down by the king, then Edmund Beaufort will take up his command in Calais and order Richard home, and our lives will get back to normal once more. Margaret summons me to her bedroom, and I go to sit with her as they lift the tight headdress that fits like a cap low over her ears, uncoil the plaits, and brush out her hair. "When do you think they will come home?" she asks. "Within the week, I guess, if all goes well." "Why should it not all go well?" I shake my head. I don't know why she should not be happy and excited, as she was when this plan was first explained to her by the Duke of Somerset. I don't know why the palace, which is always such a pretty home for the court, should seem so cold and lonely tonight. I don't know why the girl should have picked a story about a son and heir who melts away before he can inherit. "I don't know," I say. I shiver. "I expect it will all be well." "I'm going to bed," she says crossly. "And in the morning we can go hunting and be merry. You are poor company, Jaquetta. Go to bed yourself." I don't go to bed as she bids me, though I know I am poor company. I go to my window, and I swing open the wooden shutter, and I look down over the water meadows in the moonlight, and the long silver curve of the river, and I wonder why I feel so very low in my spirits on a warm May night in England, the prettiest month of the year, when my husband is coming home to me after grave danger, and the King of England is riding out in his power, and his enemy is to be brought down. Then, the next day, in the late afternoon, we get news. Terrible news. Unbelievable news. Nothing is clear to us, as we order messengers to be brought before the Queen, as we demand that men scrambling away from some sort of battle are captured and brought to the royal chambers to say what they saw, as we send men speeding out towards St. Albans on the road going north, where it seems that the Duke of York, far from riding peaceably to his ordeal, and waiting patiently to be arraigned as a traitor, instead mustered an army, and came to plead with the king that his enemies be set aside, and that the king be a good lord for all England, and not just for Lancaster. One man tells us that there was some sort of riot in the narrow streets, but that he couldn't see who had the advantage as he was wounded and was left where he fell. Nobody helped him, a thing most discouraging for a common soldier, he said, one eye on the Queen.
Makes you wonder whether your lord cares for you at all, he grumbles. It's not good lordship to leave a man down.
Another man, riding back to us with news, says that it is a war. The king raised his standard, and the Duke of York attacked, and the Duke of York was cut down. The Queen is out of her chair, her hand to her heart at this report. But later in the evening, the messenger we sent to London comes back and says that from what he can gather in the streets, the greatest fighting was between the Duke of Somerset and the Earl of Warwick's men, and that the Earl of Warwick's men fought through the gardens and over the little walls, climbed over henhouses and waded through pigsties to get to the heart of the town, avoiding the barricades and coming from a direction that no one could have predicted, surprising the Duke of Somerset's men and throwing them into confusion. Margaret strides about her room, furious with waiting, mad with impatience. Her ladies shrink back against the walls and say nothing. I stop the nursemaid in the doorway with the little prince. There will be no playtime for him this afternoon. We have to know what is happening, but we cannot discover what is happening. The Queen sends out more messengers to London, and three men are commanded to ride on to St. Albans with a private note from her to the Duke of Somerset. And then all we can do is wait. Wait and pray for the king. Finally, as it grows dark, and the servants come in with the lights and go quietly round lighting sconces and branches of candles, the guards swing open the doors and announce,
King's messenger!
The Queen rises to her feet. I go to stand beside her. She's trembling slightly, but the face she shows to the world is calm and determined.
You may come in and tell me your message, she says.
He strides in and drops to his knee, his hat in his hand.
From His Grace the King, he says,
and shows in his clasped fist a ring. Margaret nods to me, and I go forwards and take it. What is your message?
His Grace the King wishes you well, and sends his blessing to the Prince.
Margaret nods.
He says he's in good company with his fair kinsman, the Duke of York, this night, and will come in the company of His Grace to London tomorrow.
Margaret's long-held breath comes out as a little hiss.
The King bids you be of good cheer, and says that God will arrange all things, and all things will be well.
And what of the battle?
The messenger looks up at her. He sent no message about the battle.
She bites her lower lip.
Anything else?
He asks you and the court to give thanks for his escape from danger this very day.
We will do so, Margaret says. I am so proud of her restraint and dignity that I put my hand gently on her back in a hidden caress. She turns her head and whispers,